Good morning. I'm Paige Ulrey from the King County Prosecutor's Office, and I'm going to just talk a little bit about how these studies relate to my experience as an elder abuse prosecutor. I work for a prosecuting unit that is now comprised of two people and a half-time paralegal. We prosecute cases of adult neglect, sexual assault, financial exploitation, and homicide. We also are mandated by our elected to do trainings of first responders, the theory being that if we don't train people about how to respond to these cases, they're not going to come into our office. And we also work on the coordinated community response to elder abuse, that theory being that if we don't work on working with APS and working with geriatricians and others in the field who are dealing directly with elders, we're not going to be handling these cases properly. So that's just a little bit of background. And I want to spend a few minutes taking you inside the prosecutor's office because that will give some context to some of the things that Shelley was told by the prosecutor she interviewed. And I think before I do that, it's important to remember that very few of the people she talked to were specialized elder abuse prosecutors. And even of the ones that were, I can bet you that they had very little training on elder abuse prosecution, since there hardly is any. So usually in most prosecutors' offices, there are no specialized elder abuse prosecutors. And a prosecutor who's handling one or two elder abuse cases on top of their other 98 cases is not going to be having an easy time of it. They're not likely to even know what a multidisciplinary team is. They're not likely to have ever heard of Adult Protective Services. They're not likely to have connections with the elder abuse detectives in their jurisdictions, if there are any. And other cases that are murder cases or bank robberies or kidnappings that are kind of higher visibility in the office are inevitably going to take precedence. And they're also not going to have the knowledge to handle those cases effectively. Elder abuse is not sexy in the prosecutor's world. The cases are considered to be onerous. The victims, as Shelley articulated, are considered to be difficult and high maintenance, and the cases do not have cachet in a typical prosecutor's office, and that affects how they get handled. And it's true that they're difficult. These are big cases. The trials take longer. They're more complicated. They involve issues like capacity and dementia and powers of attorney and guardianships and things that, as Lori said, none of us get taught in law school. And also, elder abuse prosecution is more expensive. In almost every case I've tried, we've needed an expert witness, and that can be thousands and thousands of dollars, which is tough on a budget that is limited. Also, a lot of prosecutors' offices really emphasize convictions over justice. And convictions aren't always the best thing for our victims. So if we handle a case and it turns out that if we dismiss the case and arrange for different care for our victim and treatment and the offender's in treatment, that could actually be a better outcome for our victim than sending the defendant off to prison for the rest of his life. But the way we tend to operate as prosecutors is going to trial is valued, getting a conviction is valued, and the longer the prison term, the better, with very little regard for what's best for our victims. So that is also a thing that I think complicates how we're handling these cases, especially when we're not specialized. We also are not really trained to be empathetic with elders and elder victims in particular. A lot of prosecutors will insist on their coming in to testify, even if it means damaging their relationship with the offender, who may be the last person they have left in their lives. Again, failing to consider the needs of the victim in negotiating a case. So if, as Lori was talking about, what the victim wants more than anything is for her son, the abuser, to get alcohol treatment, that is not consistent typically with how a prosecutor is going to handle a case. That's not going to trump the esteem they get from their colleagues for sending that defendant off to prison. We also just automatically request no contact orders in our cases. There's no services or resources for supervised visitation so she can see her son. There's no thought even that maybe a blanket no contact order is actually going to do more harm to her than good. And again, and I think this is also consistent with what people told Shelley, there is a perception of elder abuse as a family matter, as not being criminal, the same way we used to think of domestic violence decades ago. We have little or no training on abuse of power of attorney cases. We don't know what undue influence is. We have no idea how to handle an adult neglect case. When we get one of those cases, we get a stack of medical records and maybe a description of a crime scene. And for most prosecutors handling that, they have absolutely no idea how to proceed, and they assume they can't. So the statute's too narrow, or they don't have enough evidence, or there's some other explanation that they come up with. But it may actually be a lack of training. We aren't taught about competency and capacity, especially with regard to elders. We don't know how to present massive bank records, which we have to do in almost every financial exploitation case we handle. We don't know how to present medical records to a jury. What do you do with that stack of records when you're trying to convey the symptoms and signs of neglect someone had? How do you present that evidence? It's just not something any of us are taught in law school or in any subsequent training that we get. We're not taught about the need to make accommodations for victims with physical disabilities or victims with dementia. And Crawford, which is also came up in Shelley's talk, is a case that basically says that elder hearsay, in other words, statements that elders make to law enforcement in an interview context, are not admissible at trial unless that elder is available to testify at trial. This is a case that came out of my lovely state and that pretty much eradicated all of the state's elder hearsay statutes that existed. So where beforehand officers could interview victims and do videotapes, and those videotapes could be offered against the defendant at trial, even if the victim had died or was no longer able to remember what had happened, after Crawford v. Washington, all of those hearsay statutes became unconstitutional. So those videotapes no longer are admissible. But there are ways around that. There are other hearsay exceptions that many victim statements still apply to. But a lot of prosecutors think about Crawford and they say, oh, we can't get in any victim statements. We can't even try if we don't have a victim. No victim, no case. And that really is, again, a training issue. We're also used to working in a silo, we as non-elder abuse prosecutors. Again, unfamiliar with APS. We're not used to staffing cases with a multidisciplinary team, if we even know what that is. We're not used to working on the coordinated community response to a problem. All of those things are foreign to how we're raised in a prosecutor's office. So these are the different explanations that Shelley was given about why elder abuse is harder to prosecute, and I just want to break down each one of those and talk about it briefly. Elders don't make good witnesses. Prosecutors, like other people, often assume that if you're older, you lack credibility, that if you're older, you suffer from dementia, and that even if you have dementia, that means automatically that you can't testify at trial. We typically lack training as to what dementia is, as to the fact that a victim actually, even with dementia, may still be able to testify depending on what time of day it is, what kind of medications they're on, how their other underlying health conditions are doing. They are unfamiliar with the UCI study that came out recently, and Eileen Wigglesworth is here with us, who worked on that study, regarding the impact of dementia on the ability to remember traumatic events. And Eileen's study actually says that even with dementia, there is evidence that you have a better recall of traumatic events than non-traumatic events. So with studies like that, we may actually be able to put on testimony of a victim who has dementia, even if they're unable to recall other parts of their history or their lives. We also lack training and knowledge of the fact that if consent is the defense and there's a dementia issue, we need to get a psychological or psychiatric evaluation of the victim. We don't just write off the case. The statement that the prosecutors made to Shelley that victims are unavailable, therefore elder abuse is harder. And certainly that's true, but I also want to give some background as to why that's true. Elder abuse, as you all probably know well, is lethal to many of our victims. Mark Lax found that elders are 300% more likely to die a premature death, no matter what kind of abuse they've suffered. still we can prosecute cases without victims. In most of the trials that I have, we don't have a victim. The victim has either died or has lost their memory of what happened. But you have medical records and you have financial records. We have evaluations that should be conducted immediately in an investigation by a geriatric psychologist or psychiatrist where dementia is an issue with your victim. We have hearsay statements that the victim made to other people. If a victim makes any statements to medical personnel about what happened to them, that's admissible in court. If the victim made excited statements to law enforcement or to a 911 operator, that's still admissible in court, even with Crawford. So a lot of the way we look at cases now is we go through all the different victim statements and we say which ones of these still fall within hearsay exceptions and can be admitted despite the fact that Crawford exists. And on the financial records point, I think people also told Shelley that financial cases are very difficult to prosecute. And I actually think they're the easiest type of elder abuse to prosecute because we have bank records. And the bank records tell a beautiful story of what happened to that victim's assets before and after the perpetrator got into their life. They also show what happened to the perpetrator's assets. So typically we will put on evidence of the perpetrator having nothing and then moving into the victim's life and suddenly buying new cars and new houses and spending money like crazy. Meanwhile, at the same time, the victim who had a lot of money, their assets very quickly go down to nothing. And at the point when they hit nothing, the perpetrator leaves their life typically. So that kind of evidence, even without a victim, can be very compelling for a jury. Obviously, you have issues if the victim consented to that transaction, but if you have evidence, or to those transactions, but if you have evidence from family members saying that the victim isolated them from, or the perpetrator isolated from them from the victim, that the perpetrator was emotionally abusive to the victim, that the victim never spent their money the way they're spending the money once the perpetrator is in their life, all of those things can come in as evidence in trial and can be used successfully. But again, it's a training issue. The next statement, weak or lack of evidence. This is purely subjective. It's claimed, sometimes it's true, but it's also claimed when a case is difficult, particularly when you have a caseload where you have one or two elder abuse cases and a bunch of other much easier, much more compelling cases. It's also claimed when you don't have the training to really understand how to prosecute a case like the one on your desk. And it's also claimed when you don't have the resources to properly try a case, when you don't have funds for expert witnesses to help prove your case, when you don't have funds for an expert to help you look at your medical evidence or your financial evidence and explain how a case like that can be proved. The statement by the prosecutors that the perpetrator acted within their rights, that scares me. I think it rings of... abuse in some way, frankly. Consent is the most common defense that we see in elder abuse cases. We see it in sexual assault cases and neglect and financial exploitation cases. And typically our perpetrators claim that what they did was within their right, that the victim consented, that this was what they were entitled to do. But we have to look beyond that simple consent that's alleged. We have to look at whether or not undue influence was used to obtain that consent. In other words, whether the perpetrator took over the victim's free will and forced that consent. We have to look at whether the victim had capacity to consent. Was their dementia so severe that they really couldn't adequately know what it was they were consenting to and give permission to it? Abuse of power of attorney, again, perpetrators who steal money under a power of attorney document typically claim it was within their right. But the reality is that a power of attorney creates a fiduciary duty to the elder. When you have a power of attorney, you are not allowed under the law of, I'm guessing all states, Lori, is that true, to spend that money for your own benefit. It must be spent for the benefit of the elder. There usually is some kind of gifting provision in the power of attorney document, but it typically creates a very clear limitation on what you can gift yourself. so we can prosecute these cases. We prosecute them as thefts, theft by embezzlement, the same way we prosecute accounting abuse cases or bookkeeper financial abuse cases. We don't need a special power of attorney statute, even though they're wonderful. So this is, again, a common misconception amongst law enforcement and amongst prosecutors, and one that has explained tremendously why we aren't handling these power of attorney abuse cases properly. Again, it's a training issue. He said, she said. That was, I think, the last explanation that they gave Shelley about why these cases are so hard. Inherent in most elder abuse cases is a lack of witnesses. These are almost always he said, she said, if the she is still alive. But the reality is that a key indicator of elder abuse is the loneliness or isolation of the victim. So almost always, we only have one witness to our crimes, and that is the victim, again, if she is still alive. So these are always he said, she said cases. The way we have to prove these cases is circumstantially. We need to look at the records that we have, like I said before. We need to look at what the family members say, the friends who had a relationship with the victim before the incident occurred, the medical records, the geriatric psychiatrist or psychological evaluation of the victim. All of those things are how we build our cases, even if we don't have any witnesses to the crime. We don't look at child abuse and write it off saying it's a he said, she said case and we can't prosecute. We don't look at domestic violence anymore and say that. So the question for us is not whether there are witnesses, but is there sufficient corroborating evidence to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt? And if there isn't, we should be able to articulate why. What evidence on what element is not sufficient? And why is it we can't prove that evidence through the surrounding circumstances and the corroboration that we have? I'm not saying these aren't hard cases, and we don't decline a lot of these cases. We do. But they're not impossible simply because we don't have any witnesses. I want to move a little bit more to Lori's topic about the specialized courts, and I think it just ties in beautifully to the need for specialized prosecutors. What a typical elder abuse victim has to go through if their case is ever prosecuted is first they have to give a statement to law enforcement about whatever horrible thing happened to them. If it's a sexual assault case, they have to undergo a rape exam. Then they usually have to meet with a prosecutor and give a statement. Then they have to submit to a typically ugly interview with the defense attorney. Then they get to wait for months or years for their case to go to trial if it doesn't plead guilty. And then at trial, they get to tell their story of having been exploited by the person they love to 12-plus strangers. Then they get to be cross-examined again by the defense attorney. Then they get to wait for sentencing, which usually takes weeks or months after the trial if there's a conviction. Then they get to wait for the appeal, which usually takes another several years before it's done. And if that is successful for the defendant, they could have to go through a retrial. All of this when they're probably in their 70s, 80s, 90s, and are having to deal with having been abused by someone they loved. The non-specialized courts that are typical in our jurisdictions, as with non-specialized prosecutors, end up losing the value of these elder abuse cases in the crush of the rest of the calendar. We end up being frustrated by the delays that are caused by the special needs of elder victims. We don't have understanding of dementia and how to accommodate victims with dementia. We typically don't have victim advocates who have specialized knowledge about how to handle disabilities and dementia and what services are available to elder victims. Shelley, the prosecutors that Shelley talked to had really great things to say about what needs to happen to reform courts, and I just wanted to put them up here again because I think they fit in beautifully with what Lori talked about as far as what the courts around the country are beginning to do. Expedited trials, enhanced penalties, priority on dockets, and courtroom accommodations for elders.